Oh, I think we may, that may be a number six person.
Good morning. We'll call the Health and Human Services Division to order for Wednesday, March 28th. We have six bills to get through here today, and we need to be done by 11. So with that, let the record note we have a quorum, and we'll get started with Senator Marty, Senate File 2155. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 2155 is a simple bill that simply allows income garnished for spousal maintenance to count as part of your personal needs allowance for people in facilities that are on MA. And it's a small group of people, but there are often people in their 70s or so who have spousal maintenance court orders, and because the system is set up the way it is, it doesn't count towards their thing, so they can never spend down, which means the facility can never get MA for them, or they can't get into the in other words, they're in a catch-22 right here. And, Mr. Chair, we do have a A1 technical amendment to tell the DHS computers what the bill says so they don't.
Right, and with the amendment, the fiscal note is drafted with the assumption that this amendment would be adopted. Is that correct?
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Rosen
moves
the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, so.
Mr. Chair, I have Melinda Hugdahl from Legal
Hugdahl,
Services.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. Thank you, first of all, for hearing this bill. This is a case, probably the takeaway from it is these are folks who can never spend down money that they never actually have. So we do put people in a catch-22, and this is really their only remedy to fix what's going on. So I'll give you a quick visual. We have some cases that we've seen where the person is typically receiving Social Security. They are obligated by court order to pay spousal maintenance, what we used to call alimony. It's withheld upstream from their payment and paid to their former spouse. When they are in a facility, have spent their other funds down, and need to become eligible for MA, MA considers it available to them, even though it's never available to them because it's been withheld automatically, and they can never spend that money down. So they're in a perpetual loop where they can never become eligible for MA. So when you are in a facility and that happens, either the facility is forced to eat all of that person's costs, which I'm sure many of you know, especially in greater Minnesota, these are facilities who are really on the margins. Or some of them are billing the family members, threatening to kick them out of the facilities because they can no longer get care. So these are really, really not good situations for anyone. We had a client with a gentleman who was 91 years old when he needed to become eligible for MA. He has severe Alzheimer's. He's in a residential facility in New Prague. His family, he had spent his money down. He has a spousal maintenance obligation of $175 a month that's withheld from his RSDI. And that obligation is considered that $175 each month is what was keeping him from being eligible for medical assistance. So it's, in some of these cases, very small amounts, but it has a huge impact. His children were getting bills, being threatened that he would have to leave the facility. Obviously, many of these folks are folks who have really significant issues that their family members are really unable to help care for them at home, which is a very difficult situation for everyone. I would also point out that we also have seen cases where it's considered available to the person paying, but if their former spouse goes on a medical assistance, the same money is counted as available to them. So we're actually counting it as available to two people at the same time. So making this in the personal needs allowance actually corrects some of that piece, which is a very good kind of accounting change that we should probably be doing. But it has a really big life game-changer impact for these families.
Senator Marty, you have one additional testifier. Mr. Thomas, is that right?
Yes.
Welcome.
This is Charles Thomas, Your Honor, Mr. Chairman from Legal Services. And I'm just here for any questions. My office handled the case for this individual and was able to settle it with DHS. But this would extend that same result to other people.
Excellent. Any questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 2155 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus. On that motion, Actually, before the motion, anyone from the public wish to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 2155? Seeing none. On Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next, we have Senate File 2804, Senator Conan. A note on both the Senator Marty's bill and Senator Conan's bill. I was looking over the House's spreadsheet, and just for members' information, both of these did make it into the House bill, so they'll be coming into the conference committee. So there's that. Senator Conan, welcome to the committee.
All right. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, committee. This bill makes a $625,000 appropriation for fiscal year 2015, and that's from the general fund to the Board on Aging, and it's for congregate dining services. And part of what drove this was, of course, the sequestration, and even though that has been restored for the most part, it's just for 1 year. When we look into the next fiscal year starting October 1, that whole roller coaster starts all over again. So I think that's important to note when it comes to funding for senior nutrition programs. And also it's important to remember with baby boomers retiring that the need for senior nutrition programs is going to grow rapidly into the future. And that has started already. But, Mr. Chairman, I do have a number of people who would like to say a few words, and sitting next to me here right now is Betty Christensen, Director of the Chippewa County Family Services.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Betty Christensen.
And provide your testimony. Welcome.
I'm here to represent both Chippewa County and Region 6W, which is five counties. Due to the sequestration, our area lost four congregate meal sites, one central kitchen, and four staff. It's estimated that there are about 25 closures in the Minnesota River Valley AAA area due to these cuts. I think it's often presumed that waiver funding can make up for other federal funding. However, nutrition providers cannot make ends meet with the Title IIIB funds. The waiver meal reimbursement is $6.14 per meal. That $6.14 has to buy the groceries, make the meal, and deliver the meal. Though we use volunteer drivers to deliver the meals, it takes staff time to recruit and coordinate the delivery of those meals. The loss of meals over the last few months has resulted in a loss of volume, which increased the cost per meal to the providers. Nutrition is a basic need for our seniors. Without nutrition, we see a result in loss of health, which increases our costs as far as adult protection services, increased medical care, and eventually a loss of independent living. The seniors also feel very isolated. I know we had one resident in our county who once she was notified that she lost a meal site. She did not leave her house for over a week because she was depressed. She just didn't have a place to go. She was very isolated. In rural Minnesota, some of our smaller towns have no options besides the congregate meal sites. They don't have a grocery store, and they don't have a local restaurant. Also, in our area, many of the seniors who are now struggling to have proper nutrition and to receive daily meals are the very people who were growing our agricultural products for their livelihood. Now, when they are elderly and they need our help, they are struggling to find their own meals. The other comment I'd like to make is that overall, the administrative requirements for The waiver programs and other programs are huge. Currently, it takes a bachelor degree social worker 60 to 80 pieces of paper to approve home care services and nutrition services for an elderly person. So I'm here to ask that this Senate File 2804 is approved, but also ask that the money goes directly to the nutrition providers, which will result in a direct service to the residents of our counties, and that no administrative costs are taken off the top. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Senator Conan. I see a couple of other testifiers. Did you have them and wish them to speak to this?
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Is that Ms. Jean Wood? In a role, a new role, I think. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Wood. I am the Director of Aging and Adult Services at the Department of Human Services, and in that role, I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. Okay. And I'm here to talk to you about, and first thank you for hearing this bill. These funds would offset the losses that we have had due to sequestration, and while 2 weeks ago we did learn that some of these funds have been restored at the federal level, sequestration is not over. I mean, this is a multi-year process, and we will once again this summer hit the same cuts, and so I think the one-time use of this money to be able to stabilize this really vital program would be funds well spent. Minnesota has provided state funds to this program prior to the federal funds being authorized, and I think it has served Minnesota well. The Board on Aging funds, through its area agencies on aging, 2.7 million meals a year that serve 61,000 people, older individuals, and this demand will only grow. And so I offer this as just some additional information for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wood. Any additional testifiers, Senator Conan?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Gauthier with Second Harvest also has a few comments.
Welcome to the committee. State
Thank
your name
you,
for the
Chairman.
Record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greta Gauthier. I am with Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank. We are a food bank based here in the Twin Cities. We serve 41 counties in Minnesota, and we serve over 1,000 food shelves and meal programs in those 41 counties. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 2804. Senior food insecurity is growing in Minnesota. Food insecurity, of course, is a lack of access to the proper amount of food to maintain a healthy lifestyle. And we have seen in the food shelves that we serve a greater than 70% increase in senior visits to food shelves since 2008. In fact, seniors are the fastest growing group of people coming to food shelves, especially the younger seniors between 60 and 65 years old. Many of these folks suffered a job loss in the economic downturn and may be working again, but not at the same level of income that they once did. And we have heard from many of them that without the food shelf, they would have to choose between medicine and food or between their mortgage payment and food. So we're seeing a rapid increase in that younger senior group using food shelves. Last week, Feeding America, which is the national association of food banks in this country, released a new report on senior hunger and health. And that report found that food insecure seniors are 53% more likely to report a heart attack, 52% more likely to develop asthma, 40% more likely to report an experience of congestive heart failure, and 60% more likely to experience depression than seniors of the same age who are food secure. And if those seniors are caring for grandchildren in their home, they are three times more likely to be food insecure. So The sequestration issue, as earlier testimony has said, will be revisited again by the Congress this summer, because as of October 1, we move into a new federal fiscal year. And regardless of the sequestration, the fact remains that 9.5% of our seniors in the state are food insecure, and that's about 90,000 seniors who are missing meals every single month. So this bill would help supply critical funds to provide more meals for these seniors and would help to reduce senior food insecurity in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. One more testifier, is that right, Mr.
Yes.
Conan? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Susie Schatz. I'm from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. And I wanted to speak to you today just to share that we provide senior nutrition services throughout much of greater Minnesota, and about 20 of the sites mentioned were our services that had to close or make some major adjustments in service in those areas. We worked very closely with the MBA and AAAs to make those adjustments and with the local communities and congregations in order to try to find other dining options. But as was mentioned, in many communities, there just weren't any other options. I just want to emphasize that these services are very cost efficient. they're getting very good at squeezing out what they can from senior nutrition services, and they're primarily volunteer run. We have about 8,000 volunteers a year in senior nutrition, and Ms. Christensen had mentioned some of the challenges. Some additional challenges are around the ability to collect spend downs is another big challenge that we see in our services. And just to emphasize, a warm, nutritious meal is often the only lifeline that many of these seniors have. And we just have multiple stories of a volunteer being the one to find a senior who has fallen or who is maybe needs some additional help and support. And it's really those volunteers who come in and see those seniors who are their lifeline and are really able to keep them independent and in their homes. And often that volunteer is the only one who sees that senior that week. So just to emphasize that. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions of members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Coonan, your very first testifier made mention of a loss of volume. I didn't quite catch the context.
Ms. Christensen?
Thank you. Due to the cuts through the sequestration, there was a loss of volume in regards to the number of meals that our nutrition providers can provide. And so when you lower the number of meals you're able to provide and able to get paid for, then the cost for the remaining meals goes up.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yeah, that answers that question. My other question was about, and Ms. Christensen, it isn't specifically for you, so I don't want to have you be on the hot spot, but you had also mentioned no administrative costs, and Senator Coonan, in the language here that we have, does that accomplish that so we maximize the dollars going to these, because these are very thin margins, so does the language in this bill accomplish maximizing getting the dollars out to the actual seniors and those who directly provide?
Senator Conan?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kiefmeyer, you're right, that language isn't in the bill, and I may need help with staff on this, but I think that there's already in statute that this money goes for meals and not administrative costs, but maybe a staff can help me with that.
Ms. White, is this your area? I mean, I think that in you'll see in section one that's being amended that they have to be delivered in a manner consistent with federal requirements. I think that's where that comes in. But Ms. Wood, you have some.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the current state law requires that any state funds that we receive for nutrition go to raw food and preparation, and none of it is permitted to go for administrative money.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad that is clarified because I think that's a really important component of this, especially when you look at $625,000 statewide.
Senator Eakin?
Mr. Chair and Senator Coonan, and this question probably be directed towards the testifier from Lutheran Social Services. I know you talked about the the volunteers that participate in this, in these programs. And I think that needs to be taken into consideration as well, the fact that it's not just the allocation of the revenue that we're looking at here, it's the volunteer services that that money leverages as well. Is there any estimate or any kind of value that's placed on that volunteer activity and so what we're leveraging for the money that's being put into these programs?
I know there absolutely is, but Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, there is, but I'll need to get back to you with those specifics.
Thank you.
I can do that. Thanks.
Any other questions of members? Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the bill, but I just wanted to say I think this is, even though the feds we're making amends for the Fed's lack of funds here. I do think this is probably one of the wisest prevention measures that you can use. And it's, as we all know, if these adults these seniors have an adequate meal every single day, they can live longer. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate file 2804 recommended to pass into the HHS article.
Laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article of the omnibus finance bill.
That article is messing us up.
Yep. That's all. I know. It tripped me up, too. I have it written, though. I could. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying, wait. Anyone from the audience wish to offer additional testimony, either in support or opposition, to Senate file 2804? Seeing none, on Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Cornyn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
If there's any money left on the bottom line, I know sometimes these things happen. This seems like a small amount of money. If we can bump that up a bit, and I know that, you know, where you're at every now and then, just to maybe consider that.
Thank you for the comment. Senator Miller, I see. Senate File 1767, Region 10 Quality Council. Proposal to go statewide, correct? Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. It is good to be here this morning, and I thank you and appreciate you, you hearing Senate File 1767 here this morning. If members remember, I was here last session with the same type of legislation, so I'm going to move fairly quickly and allow our testifiers to share their thoughts, but I'll run it through just some changes. In Section 1, we just add a date, July 1st, 2014, by which the State Quality Council must design a transition plan for licensed providers from Region 10 into the alternative licensing system. Section 2, we list the three quality councils the commissioner must establish or continue to operate by July 1st, 2014. And it also requires the commissioner to establish three more regional councils by July 1st of 2016. And perhaps most importantly, in Section 3, and this goes to Senator Kiffmeyer's point, if there is money on the bottom line, we would certainly like to have some of that as well. We appropriate $2.021 million in fiscal year 2015 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Human Services for quality assurance initiatives for services provided to people with disabilities. And the amounts are broke down: $381,000 to the State Quality Council, $1.29 million to the three regional quality councils, and $350,000 to fund an annual survey of disability service recipients. So that's the overview of the bill in front of you, members. And with that, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to pass it over to our testifiers. Mr. Larson, I'm assuming, is going first.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, but today I'm here as the co-chair of the State Quality Council. As Senator Miller said, in 2011, comprehensive legislation was passed to create the State Quality Council. The council was convened in March 2012, and after a year of highly facilitated work, we produced the March 2013 State Quality Council report, which came up with the recommendations that we're talking about here today. And that includes developing a system that's data-driven, that gives a voice to persons with disabilities. So when I speak about data-driven, I'm talking about data that's collected through a variety of surveys of persons with disabilities. I'm also talking about looking at vulnerable adult reports and other data that the state currently collects but isn't as thoroughly analyzed as it should be to look for trends in disability services and look for opportunities to improve those services. We want to develop a system that gives a voice to persons with disabilities and is proactive and not just reactive. Since 1998, the ARC Minnesota has been working on quality legislation. And in 2007, I was sitting at this very same table, and we worked on legislation to that was a precursor to this to develop a State Quality Council or a report at that point in time. We did not receive funding during the 2013 legislative session, but the State Quality Council continues to work with some support from the Department of Human Services, so we can continue to keep this effort going, but we can't do the comprehensive work that is described here. The governor's supplemental budget does have funding for quality work. Unfortunately, it's reactive funding. The governor's supplemental budget has $1.4 million that is being requested to follow through on the Jensen settlement. 390 people were in the class of individuals that were abused at the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, and the governor is asking for 7 staff to follow up on those individuals. So we can continue to react, or we can start a proactive system. It's just not $1.4 million. There's $1.8 in the next biennium for each year, so there's tails to that. So we are going to pay. It's just a matter of whether we pay up front or not. That settlement consisted of $3 million paid out to the 390 people. We're now being asked to pay $315,000 for payment to a special court master, and we're doing all of the costs to fund the Olmstead Implementation Office. We feel strongly as advocates that if we had had a State Quality Council system in place in which we were giving a voice to persons with disabilities, we could have avoided some of these costs. We could have avoided some of the abuse that happened. Not all of it. Bad things are going to happen. We can't prevent it all. But now we have a system of licensing which tries to assure minimal standards. But we don't have a system of quality, a quality framework in which the voice of persons with disabilities can be heard. So with that, I'm going to conclude my testimony and introduce Kurt Rutzen, who's an advocate for the ARC Minnesota.
Mr. Rustin, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Kurt Rutzen with the ARC of Minnesota. Thank you for hearing me this morning. What I wanted to say this morning, you guys, and I wish I could stand up, but you wouldn't hear me. So, but we can talk about this all day long. But if we, you and I, don't learn to listen to persons with disabilities, we're not going anywhere. And we're not listening to people with disabilities. Disability people need to be heard now, not in the future, right now. The only reason that MEDO lawsuit came to a head, I believe, and this is common sense, is that somebody with a disability spoke up and somebody listened to them. He listened intently and very, very well. We need to start doing that. We need to start listening to persons with disabilities. Is there a theme here? Or, I mean, I think it's listen. People like to be around other people with disabilities. And I believe that they can listen. They listen to each other, and they care about each other. And, I mean, you guys, I'm not pointing fingers or trying to hop or trying to be so hard on you all, but we just need to listen, listen, listen. You and I need to listen more to persons with disabilities, what they want and what they need, not a checklist of stuff. What, this is done, this is done, this is done. That's what the old system has in place. That what the old system has in place. We need to listen. What does Billy and Johnny and Sally want and need in their life? And then we can tailor it to them. Let's take it up a notch. You know, you guys, come on. We need to take it up a notch, or maybe five notches. So I thank you for listening this morning, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rutson. Senator Miller, any additional testifiers?
One more. We got Mr. Zimmer here.
Mr. Zimmer, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
I'm Dan Zimmer, Director of Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. Since 1999, Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance has been working with a regional approach to quality assurance, quality improvement, quality management for persons with disabilities. And we do it by listening to the people that are being served. We do that by listening to families. We do that by listening to direct care staff and providers and case managers. We do that by listening to schools and other, I'd say, non-typical licensed services, churches. We have what's called a voice review, and our voice review starts with a person and all the supports that are around that person. And we try to understand, what does that person need? What does that person want? What does that person dream of? And then how is everybody working together to make that as much of a reality as possible? And from that, we're able to generate great information. We're able to generate information that providers can use to improve services, that county case managers can use to do their job, that families can use to help support their family member better, and that the person with disabilities can use to make sure that they are being heard and they are doing things. I was asked today to come and speak with you to talk a little bit about why we believe that the regional councils would be effective in quality improvement and quality assurance and quality management. And I think a lot of it is because it is local. We are seen as part of, you know, the providers see us as a positive. They see us as someone that they want to see to come in and have a voice review and give them feedback as to how they're doing. They want to see where they can improve, and they work very hard to improve when they find that. We're able to use the data we collect in the voice review for three different purposes. So we're going in and collecting information, and not just using it once, but we're using it multiple times in our system. First, we give all that information to that person and their family and their quality circle so they can make improvements. And that comes right away. That's immediate. That's right at the end of that voice review. So they're not waiting a year to find out what are the results. They're not waiting any time. They're getting that information right away. We also, because we look at the whole life of a person, we influence those providers or community members that are not licensed. So if a person that's being reviewed is in a school, we're talking to the school, we're talking to the teachers, the paraprofessionals. If they want to include their church, we've gone in and talked to churches, helping them become a stronger part of that person's life. We've talked to YMCAs and recreation facilities and things that you don't typically normally think would be assessed and given direction as to how they can improve. Because we're about that person, we give information to a lot of different people. We also use it as a quality assurance that back look, that when a provider is up for a license review, we can take their reviews in a congregate and see how have they done over time, how have they structured their supports for each individual person that they're doing, and we can make recommendations on their license. We also take a look at that information for system barriers. That's the last thing where we're looking at how can we improve the system. What are the things that are getting in the way, whether it's transportation or funding streams or things like that? Where are there improvements that can be made in that system? We're constantly evaluating ourselves, trying to make ourselves better. The voice reviews that were done in the year 2000, I think the voice reviews we're doing now are of higher quality. We're learning. We're getting better. We're continually asking ourselves, are we doing what we set out to do? That's what I think our state needs. I think our state needs every region doing that. And we're excited that this could happen. We're excited that we can share our experience with other regions and help them move in that progression. And with other regions starting to do this as well, it's going to make us better too. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer. Senator Miller, is that the end of your testifiers?
That is the end of our testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Questions from members? Senator Sharon?
I would just like you to explain for me a little bit what the last part of the bill, there's language referring to a survey, dollars set aside for a survey of the disability community, the last appropriation. Could you help me understand more broadly? I don't see any language to help me understand what that is about and what that's attempting to accomplish.
Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that's the personal experience survey, the $350,000 allocation I think you're referring to. This is a survey that we developed after the passage of our 2007 legislation, and the purpose of that survey is to talk directly to persons with disabilities, identify the areas in their life that are working or not working, and then to make improvements based on that. I think one of the most recent surveys that they've done is that we've reinforced the fact that the rate of employment for persons with disabilities was lower than they would like, and so it provides us the data to show that people with disabilities are interested and willing to work but don't have that opportunity.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. It is a tool you need, apparently, what you're saying to me, in order to accomplish the objective, which is to get the voice of the disabled person in the mix of decision-making for quality. So thank you for that.
Senator Rosa?
Mr. Chair, is anybody from the department need to comment on this? If there's some questions for them.
I think there's folks here from the department. Somebody willing to come up and take a question or two?
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Senator Rosen.
When did we pass the Olmstead compliance? That was last year. Is that correct?
Olmstead compliance is a plan that DHS is working on. I don't think we had a great deal of legislation to implement it to date. I think that, you know, pieces of what we're looking at this year and next year, too, I mean, we're going to have to make the legislative changes to accommodate what we have to do to be in compliance with Olmstead as we move forward. But we didn't really have a good grasp of what would be needed last year when we were working, and so these plans came out, you know, in the interim, and we're evaluating some of them.
My question, Mr. Chair, was to the department, to Ms. Erber, about the if this State Quality Council is essential to that Olmstead plan and how that's going to work.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Carrie Erber, and I'm with the Continuing Care Administration, DHS. I believe I might defer to Heidi on this question, just so she has more of the policy background on that.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm Heidi Hamilton with the Disability Services Division at DHS. We definitely believe that the work of the State Quality Council is essential to some of the work that we're doing. They provide a voice of the individual. Our director, Alex Bartolik, and also Jerry Kerver from the Office of Inspector General, both are members of the State Quality Council. And so we do believe that they provide a valuable source of information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Also, to perhaps Ms. Hamilton, is the work of the council, this State Quality Council, required by CMS for the management of our waiver programs?
Ms. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, CMS does not specifically require a State Quality Council, although there are several components that the department has to meet in order to comply with the waiver plan quality components, and we do rely, or we plan on relying on the State Quality Council to meet some of those criteria, such as hearing from people with disabilities and monitoring quality across the state.
Any further questions of members? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand the need for quality, and things are changing in the way that we help people with disabilities lead full lives. Generally, and I only know this from a corporate level, and I don't mean to compare quality in our systems to corporately, but generally when you roll out a quality program, it's expensive at the beginning, and then you get in the habit of quality and you continually improve, and so you don't need the same level of intensity and management. Do you foresee a time that this will back off the number of personnel that are involved and quality will be a habit instead of a management tool?
Ms. Hamilton, Ms. Erber?
I believe that the dollars would stay about the same because we've added more. The quality councils are being phased in, and by fiscal year 17, there's 6 regional councils. And most of that funding is for staffing the regional councils and different per diem costs for people that are on the regional council. So I don't know if Heidi has anything to add on that, but we believe the funding would be needed to be ongoing.
So, I mean, I was looking at the ramp up of it. I see, 7 FTEs in 15, 10 in 16, 16 in 17, but that would be considered a mature level for this system, and it wouldn't grow, but it wouldn't trail off either, is what you're saying, Senator Benson?
My concern is we're building in a structure, and I understand there's a learning curve, and we need to get people trained, and we need to transform our systems. But once the transformation's done and quality is a habit, will we be spending as much staff time once we've passed the learning curve and once we've passed training? If you put a corporation through Kaizen or Lean training, huge expense up front, but once the quality is built in, then the costs tail off. You start to see the benefits, but there's the management costs also tail off. And I don't see any indication that after the learning's done, after the training's done, after quality becomes a habit, that management backs off and moves on to another project.
Ms.
Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I think it's difficult to predict because this is a new process that we haven't had in Minnesota before, but I don't know how we would back off when it's regionally based. Would we have fewer regions? I mean, it would be something that we'd have to evaluate in the future as this becomes a habit, as this is something that is common practice. Would we still need as many regional councils? I think that'd be something we'd have to look at in the future.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, it's not necessarily to decrease the number of regional councils, but there are fewer meetings. There's just less time spent on learning and training, and it becomes part of your operations that everyone understands what quality is, and so you spend less time sitting around a table and more time getting things done. And I would like to see some tail off in the amount of time spent in meetings and more focus on the tail end of operational excellence.
Can I add one other thing?
Ms. Erber.
Just so you know, the original language was indicating fiscal year 15, but it wasn't specific enough to have an end date. on it, so that's why we fiscal noted out into the tails. And so, you know, if this would continue, we would need that funding. But the original intent, I believe, of the bill was to just include 15 and then figure out things afterwards. But Steve Nelson would have to speak to that. So, Steve Larson, I'm sorry.
Yep. So, I mean, I think, you know, the governor's budget was mentioned and the quality that's in there reacting in terms of the Johnson settlement is a good point. But there's also another piece in the governor's budget that kind of speaks to this, and that is that there's an attempt to get at quality. 1% of the increase to home and community-based waivered services is set aside for quality. It drew a lot of conversation when the governor's budget was presented, and the only approach to it was a, you know, one-page online form asking providers to say what they might do. I mean, it kind of speaks to the need to really understand how we do move in a direction of greater quality, and the lack of understanding of exactly how to accomplish that today. And I think that the Quality Council has done a good job of helping us to understand and might be a path to consider. I know Senator Franzen had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is more regarding representation. Hearing from the testimony that we do need to have some more representation and listen to disability service recipients and their family members, on page 3 of the bill, it has a series of people that are part of these councils that we're now expanding. And my concern is that, and I've heard this from some of my constituents, that on the first prong, disability service recipients on line 3.25 and their family members, that representation is that just one person, two people, three people? I'm not sure if this legislation, if we're going to expand this, it's going to address some of the concerns that I've heard of lack of really voicing the representation outside of providers, outside of advocacy groups, but actual recipients and their family members. So I don't know if it's another part of the bill that I'm missing, but that's something that I'd like to have addressed to make sure that it's not just one person that fits those two buckets or one person of each. I think that needs to be looked at because that's who we want to listen to.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, that's an excellent point. Unfortunately, my co-chair, Lance Hagelin, who's a person with disabilities, was unable to make it today because of PCA issues in getting to meetings before 10 o'clock in the morning. So, yes, there are some people on the State Quality Council, self-advocates, persons with disabilities. However, we have also lost persons with disabilities because we have no funding for the State Quality Council to compensate for stipends or mileage or anything at this point in time. So Minnesota has a long ways to go in order to develop a system that accommodates, provides accommodations for persons with disabilities to participate in many of the committees, including the State Quality Council. So that is something we need to strive for. The Region 10 Quality Commission also has several people with disabilities. And for instance, Mr. Rutson forgot to mention that he was the past chair of the Region 10 Quality Council. And just also to address briefly Senator Benson's questions, this system that we're talking about really enhances the use of volunteers. And for instance, I participate as a co-chair of the State Quality Council. Not a nickel of my time is paid for by any state or federal dollars. I volunteer or the ARC Minnesota volunteers my time to participate on that. People that participate in the voice reviews, we have many volunteers that participate in that. So we can build a system that uses the resources that we have, and in actuality, the cost per voice review has dropped. So I think Senator Benson's point is right on.
Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, and I was just going to ask Mr. Larson, as far as the regional quality councils, is there an idea where they're going to be located exactly, the locations? I'm just wondering how distributed throughout the state they would be. And greater Minnesota is obviously a very large area to cover, so just wondering how well distributed they would be.
Mr. Chair and Senator
Larson.
Eakin. The regional councils would cover all of the state, but we have not come up with those areas yet because we haven't had the funding to do the planning to precisely look at that. But if we would get the $2 million, we're looking at funding the southeast Minnesota area, one metro regional council, and another one in another region in greater Minnesota to begin with in the first year.
Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the goal here. I think I share some of the same concerns about the how, not whether it should be done. And one of the things is on line 3.25 is in regards, I've noticed here that it says disability service recipients and their families all in one line. I want you to know that many people that are in a disability situation have very active family members. And they're an excellent source, and I think they should have their own line. And that we would add to this disability service recipients and on a separate line, disability service recipients, family members, because I think we all know how many times it's the family members. You want to talk about volunteers. Those family members do a huge amount and help the system and our voice and advocate for those people, because many people with disabilities cannot even be their own voice.
Senator Kiffmeyer, are you wishing to make that a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe staff can say what the motion would.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on page 3, line 25, we'd strike "and their family members." And on the line below that, insert clause 2. And says disability service recipients, family members. And renumber the subsequent clauses.
Senator Miller, on that motion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, members, we would consider that a friendly amendment.
Any comments on that motion? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that we don't want to do the same thing on page 1, line 116. I haven't read that in context. But do we need to change the membership of the initial State Quality Council, or is that... I just want to check if we're going to make an amendment.
Maybe council could say whether that would need to be made there as well.
It would have the same effect as on page 3, so for consistency's sake, yes.
Yep. Then I would amend the amendment.
All right, I'll read.
Make the language match. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair and members, on page 1, line 16, strike "and their family members," and then the line below that, insert clause 2, and say disability service recipients, family members.
Everyone understand that motion? Senator Franzen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I completely agree. That was the point of my earlier comment, but I still have the concern that listening to the conversation, the testimony, that at times we might not have someone there. So I think it's critical to have at least one person, but ideally you have more than just one perspective and one voice on either group. So I'm still looking, and I'd love to work with Senator Miller on trying to find the appropriate percentage or being creative, because I think this piece is critical for what we're trying to do here in terms of listening to the recipients and family members and not just focusing the conversation on how to efficiently serve them, but also having that input be not just one-sided or one person's perspective. But I'll support the amendment.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify. On the disability service recipients, and maybe Mr. Larson can answer that, is there a need sometimes possibly for the disability service recipients to include "and their family members"? Do we need to strike that at all, or do we just need to add something? Because sometimes a disability service recipient needs their family member there with them. I just wanted to clarify because I don't have that specific experience. I just don't know if it's necessary to strike "and their family members" on the parenthetical one.
Mr. Chair and
Mr.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I don't think we need to address that any further from the standpoint that in the situations that you're describing, I think family members are welcome to help support the person with disabilities, as is their PCA or whatever other accommodations they need in order to fully participate in the meeting. So,
okay.
Right. That would be my read, too, that then they'd have the support that they needed to get there, but it would be the recipient themselves that held that seat under this. And it's still with both those modifications a friendly amendment, Senator Member?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members.
Any further questions? Seeing none on Senator Kiffmeyer's oral amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill? Anyone from the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1767? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1767, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus. Any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Chair and members.
Senator Rosen, Senate File 973. Oh, okay. Senator Rosen, I understand you have an amendment that's being handed out to members.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And there is some handouts also coming to you.
Yes.
Senator Rosen, this is your first committee stop, so the A3 would be an author's amendment. Senator Rosen moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. And before I explain the A3 amendment, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just give you a little bit of historical basis to the this Senate File 973. It's a critical access nursing facility bill that was in place in 2012. But back in 2011, the department and some stakeholders, with me included, they went around the state and did the stakeholder groups to talk about the vision of long-term care and what's happening out to our long-term care industry. So they met in Waseca, Alexandria, and New Hope. They were very well attended, and about some criteria and suggestions came out because of that. In June of 2012, after the bill passed, there was another stakeholder group that was formed with DHS and the Department of Health to basically formalize what that criteria was going to be. The goal of the, I want to call it CANF if we can, is, and this is in statute, to preserve access to nursing facility services in isolated areas, rebalance long-term care, and improve quality. And that's a very, very good mission statement, I'd say, Mr. Chair and members. So there was 19 criteria that were developed, but they basically came down to 5. And before I get into that criteria, I just want to talk about some of the benefits of the designation, or why you would want to be designated as a CANF site. Is number one, it's partial rebasing, with operating payment rates being the sum of 60% of the operating payment rate and 40% of the operating payment rate that would have been allowed had the facility not been designated. Number two, the enhanced payments for leave days equal to 60% of the resident's total payment rate allowed when the occupancy of the CANF, inclusive of bed hold days, is equal to or greater than 90%. Number three, it has the opportunity to apply to the Department of Health for a waiver for 2 CANFs with up to 100 beds to jointly employ a director of nursing. Number four, a reduced minimum threshold for having a capital project recognized for purposes of rate setting. And number five, value-based reimbursement features that specifically use the variable rate-related limits based on quality scores. And those are some of the benefits. Those were the suggestions that came out of these stakeholder groups.
After the five criteria were considered by the stakeholder group, there was a public comment that was posted by DHS. And the criteria is very simple: geographic isolation, size and occupancy. Number three, the high out-migration from the county. Number four, the relatively low beds per age intensity adjusted for 1,000 elderly in the county. And number five, quality. And then they also had to write a 500-word essay. There was 59 applicants to it, which was actually, they were very impressed how many people applied for this CANF designation. With the $500,000 that was provided in the last cycle, there was seven that were awarded with this, and you do have a chart, Mr. Chair, or, you know, a handout as far as who was awarded and their amounts. And also you have a list of some of the nursing homes that have closed to date. Of the $500,000, there's only about $4,300 left. So they did a very good job at making sure that the funds were out there. There was, as far as the applicants, of the 59 applicants, 30 were in the southern part and 28 were in the northern part. The other handout is a map that shows you where those designations were. And as you can see, there was only one in the southern part, mostly all in the northern part. And so there was some adjustment that was talked about this year. Not that, I mean, there's certainly reason for many of these nursing facilities out in Greater Minnesota to have them, but I think some of the distance requirements skewed it towards northern Minnesota, and that's just how it is. So I think for the amount of dollars that was spent, it was labor intensive for the department. But with the $2 million that we're asking in this bill, I think there's going to be, now that the criteria is set, the labor's been done, the industry knows about this, they are excited about it. I think this is another tool for them, and we can actually utilize these dollars and spread them out through the state. So the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair and members, basically gives the authority really back to the commissioner to ensure that there's even distribution of designations across the state. And we vacillated on many ways to make sure that we got a better distribution of these funds through the state. But now I think really, you know, if one of these original sites needs to be designated as a critical access nursing facility again, well, then so be it. And so it wasn't fair to say, well, if you had it one year, you can't have it another. We talked about having in each region. And so now it's just give the commissioner the ability to make sure that this is evenly distributed. Some of the other changes in the amendment is
an increase in the appropriation.
Increase, yes, exactly. And so instead of one of the issues was the up to 60%,
yeah.
And that is why I have Mr. Meyer here, and he would like to talk about that. So we adjusted that to say the commissioner could give like a 20% rounding error on either side of there. And then, on the original bill 2.3, after designated, commissioner may adjust these percentages up to 20% and may approve a request for less than the amount allowed. And then, of course, the different appropriation from 1.5 to 2 million. So,
that one jumped off the page. Yeah.
I'm sure it did. That's your job. So, with that, Mr. Chair, I also have Greg DeBell from the department that would like to fill in the blanks, and Tim Meyer from northern Minnesota who would like to talk about his issue and why this bill is so critical.
Mr. DeBell, is it? Did you wish to offer testimony?
Mr. Chair, I'm Greg Tfell from the Department of Human Services. I'm here to answer any questions that might come up that the senator would be unable to answer.
Okay. Mr. Meyer?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tim Meyer. I'm here today to represent Boundary Waters Care Center. It's a 45-bed nursing home up in Ely, Minnesota. I am here in support of Senate File 973, the Critical Access Nursing Facility Funding Bill. And as Senator Rosen had said a moment ago, this is funding that has been tested. And interestingly enough, Boundary Waters Care Center was actually selected for this funding and uniquely chose not to accept it. And the reason we didn't at the time was that Boundary Waters Care Center had an extraordinary amount of private pay residents. And this funding bill, as you mostly, and I'm sure all of you know, we would need to go to our private pay residents and say that your rate is going to go up by anywhere from $20 to $40 per day during the time of the pilot. So we, the board and management, chose not to fund it at that point or participate, much as we were selected. It was a tough decision. It was a decision that probably meant we left a couple $100,000 behind last year. But we knew that this nursing home needed this funding. It was really critical for its future. This is a nursing home that at its peak had 99 residents. Today runs at a census of about 32, but still doing really good work in the town of Ely, providing services to those 3,500 residents and their family members in the area. Just a couple other key points, too. Boundary Waters, like many deep rural nursing homes, is a key component of healthcare delivery in the respective communities. The typical demographic of deep rural communities is an aging population. We heard about that a little bit ago. It's dependent on nearby services to meet the healthcare needs, whether it's short or long-term healthcare. In recent years, with falling occupancy among deep rural nursing homes, meeting the financial obligations on the current funding system has become a great challenge. The critical nursing facility funding provided in 973 will give approximately a dozen nursing homes the funding needed to continue to operate in their communities. Through the good work of Senator Rosen and other legislators, this concept has been tested, seven, as we had heard a moment ago, did participate in this pilot to what I would consider a success. That was the tryout phase. We would love to see this turn into permanent funding under this current bill. Let me just give you a couple statistics about Boundary Waters Care Center, because I think this matters as you're looking at real impact, because I think that resonates with this committee. This is a nursing home that we, over the last 5 years, reduced expenses by nearly $1 million on $4 million of revenue. No small task. That was staff reductions, renegotiating contracts. You can imagine from an operations standpoint what that may have included. This year, for our best attempt at 32, 34 residents per day, we're looking at losing about $200,000, and that's real live cash. Unfortunately, there's no cash reserves. There's no local funding source through city or other measures that could immediately step up and give us a hand to continue operating. Really, the nursing home is at risk of closure in this calendar year if we don't figure out some solution along the lines of the canned funding. Here's another impact. if Ely closes, if Boundary Waters Care Center closes, the next closest nursing home is Virginia, which is 45 miles away. So imagine the scenario of the 82-year-old wife jumping in her car, driving down Highway 169 to go visit her husband in Virginia in the dead of winter. It's a lovely drive, but it's a treacherous drive in the winter. These are the realities of what happens if nursing homes like Boundary Waters Care Center closes. The economic impact is about $4 million of lost revenue to that community. 50 direct jobs. Peripherally, we've not added up what happens beyond our own 50 employees. In a town of 3,500 people. Just want to close by really asking for your help now to advance this bill, 973. We think it's critical to meeting the deep rural needs of our older adults in the state of Minnesota. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Any questions of members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the bill. Critical access nursing facilities have done a good job. My question for you, though, would be, of the percent of residents in Boundary Waters, what percent are local from Ely?
Can we go local for that area? I'd like to include, like, within 20 miles because it's so deep rural and it's such a small town.
Close enough.
That answer is probably 80 to 90%. City of Ely is probably 70%. So it's mainly people right in the area. It doesn't have an extraordinarily far reach.
And Mr. Chairman, yeah, that's a really important consideration in regards to this because sometimes nursing homes or assisted living facilities are folks moving to be closer to their children and they're not necessarily local. But as I suspected in deep rural, it is not the same, especially critical access. So I appreciate hearing that. And the question I have for you in addition is the future of Boundary Waters. Your census is down to 32. Is this something that, you know, what's kind of the future? And I think it is critical right now. We take care of the folks who need this right now. No question about it. Yeah. But it's an additional question about the future.
Mr. Meyer?
Well, yeah, thank you. What we have said is that, we're at a point now where this census of 30 to 35 is really a point at which if we drop much below it, say 25 or 20, it becomes hard to operate at any level, really. Your question about the future, I wish I had a great way to answer it, because here's what I can tell you. If you go to market demographic information, it says our census should be about 50. But it's also a very complicated formula because that area particularly, if we're talking about Boundary Waters for a moment, has an extraordinary amount of older adults living there because they chose it as a retirement destination or retirement community in which to live. So the older adult data suggests there's more people that would actually go to Boundary Waters Care Center when, in fact, what might happen, which is what you described earlier, those people, once they retire, they become frail. They then head back to the cities to live near their daughter or their son. So we say 32. It's the market. We're it in that community. We're it for 40-ish miles. So, there continues to be older adults in the area that need the services.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I support this because I think it's named appropriately, critical access. And these are times and seasons where this is critical for them in this time right now. But I appreciate that because you're a testifier we don't often get to see all the way from Ely, Minnesota, and to get a real feel for the actual boots on the ground insight to the situation. But Mr. Chair, I do support this. Thank you.
Thank you. I see that there's a couple of other testifiers that have signed up. Maybe you turn to them. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Whichever way, Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. Today, on behalf of Care Providers in Minnesota, along with our partners in the Long-Term Care Imperative. You've heard a lot about this approach, and we just want to echo that from our long-term care imperative perspective, this is an approach that allows another, if you will, tool in the toolbox to address the concerns of nursing homes in greater Minnesota. The bill does expand the successful critical access program that passed a couple years ago. It's important that we look at, as previous testifiers looked, critical access hasn't gone away. In fact, it becomes more and more urgent every year. The bill does raise the larger policy question, which is basically, what are we going to do about paying for our nursing homes? Specifically, how do we ensure quality senior care services to our seniors who deserve them in greater Minnesota? Nursing homes continue to struggle in large part because of the state's lack of a reimbursement system. Thank you. Last year, you gave us a 5% increase. That was the only increase in the last 5 years. Costs keep going up. Without increases, facilities continue to struggle. You heard the story of Ely. It's not uncommon out in greater Minnesota for that to be the story. With rate equalization, you also set the rates at which folks can charge. So without increases in a reimbursement system, basically you leave us with very few choices but to come every year and ask for money. We need a different system. Again, this is a great tool in the toolbox that addresses critical needs in different areas, but it does beg the larger question.
Ms. Thurlow?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy at Aging Services and here on behalf of the Imperative. And I want to just expound a little bit on a couple of the points that Mr. Pearson made. And I want to say that, you know, I think it was 57 facilities applied for this money when it was a pilot program. That probably shouldn't be a surprise to any of you in this room. And it probably won't be a surprise to you that it will probably be very close to that number, if not more, if this bill moves forward. And we do want to thank Senator Rosen for bringing this bill forward. We do think that it's important. I know you've heard us talk about some of the challenges faced, and Mr. Meyer did a great job of providing you a real-world example, but kind of just taking a step back and kind of reminding you folks that you know, the lack of the system that we have today has created a number of problems for our care centers. You've heard us talk about the wage gap. A registered nurse can make over $35,000 a year more in a hospital than in a long-term care setting. A nursing assistant can make over $11,000 a year more in a hospital setting than in a care center. You know, these wages, this wage gap problem is a significant contribution to our difficulty in recruitment and retention. We just did a survey of our care center members in 2014, and there are more than 1,800 vacant positions at the time that we surveyed. Members are reporting that as the economy picks up, that they're struggling with those vacancies. And that's important because it's one of the symptoms that leads to care center closures. We just had a care center closure last fall in Hoffman, Minnesota. And when the former administrator was interviewed by Minnesota Public Radio, he indicated that the facility had 33 beds open, or 33 beds that they could fill. But in fact, they could only staff to 27 because despite their advertising out there and recruitment for staff, they could not get enough staff to staff for more than 27 beds. And that, of course, led to losses. They reported that over the last 4 or 5 years, they lost over $1.5 million. And the facility was on track last year to lose more than $400,000. And so you can see that spiral effect. So programs like the Critical Access Program will do a great job at stabilizing those small rural facilities that are facing these issues today. But I do need to echo what Mr. Pearson said, that we do look forward to working with all of you in this room to figure out a system. Probably not this year. We recognize it's a supplemental budget year. But going forward, we do need something more permanent to address this throughout the state, and certainly not just addressing our rural homes, but to care centers throughout the state. So, again, thank you, Senator Rosen, for bringing this forward. Thank you to the committee for hearing us out today.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With this allocation of $10 million, how many facilities can you...
Two.
I'm sorry.
I'll take 10.
Looking at the wrong bill.
Payden wants 10.
Mr. Chair, we wouldn't argue with 10 either.
with the $2 million allocation, how many additional facilities would you see could be served?
Mr. Tabell probably is best equipped to answer that. Senator Rosen?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, I was hoping that was an oral amendment on your part, but the because of the adjustment on the operating rate up to 60%, we will be able to serve more facilities and I think have a better flexibility with that. But if Mr. Tabell would like to fill in the gap, then
Mr. Tabell.
Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen, it will depend on who applies because it is a rate adjustment that allows them to, you know, add on to their operating rate, and it allows them now under the bill to choose how high they want to go. So it would depend on what their rate is now, how high they can go, and how high they want to go because of the private pay issue that the representative from Boundary Waters spoke of. I can tell you that the seven facilities from the pilot round spent $500,000, and that was in right around a year's time. It was some of them had their rate adjustment started at a different time, but it was pretty close to a year. So, you know, you could probably safely say it would be a dozen at least that would be able to get in the program with higher funding, again, depending on what their rates are and how much they want out of the program.
Mr. Tabell, a dozen on top of the seven? Or is that assuming the seven or a dozen total?
I would say, safely you could say a dozen total.
Okay. Senator Claussen?
Yeah, and just to follow up, this is for 2 years, is that correct?
This is ongoing appropriation.
This would be ongoing.
Because of some of the issues that Mr. Meyer discussed. I mean, they actually were awarded and turned it down because it was just a pilot program for 1 year, and they didn't feel that allowed them the sustainability to actually take advantage of it and use it in a way that, that actually benefited them. So by making it a permanent, I think it'll be something that our fragile nursing home industry, those that, that make it through the process, can rely on into the future.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I would like to thank the department, specifically Bob Held, who is at a convention this week, too, and Mr. DeBell, they and MDH, they worked very hard on adjusting this and getting this up and going. They are going to have further adjustments to do. I think they'll work some on the criteria, the size and occupancy, the rounding portions of it, but that's all eternal. They are committed to this, and I personally think a dozen is on the very, very low end, especially with this adjustment of the operating rates, the percentages. We will be able to serve many, many more critical access. And from just talking to the folks that did apply, the application was, there was no complaints about the application. Maybe on the essay, not on the application.
And I've got a clarification on my statements that I don't mean to indicate that somebody who was approved in the first round is there forever. You have to reapply every 2 years. So there is a sustainability issue that I think will make people more willing to take it, but it doesn't lock you in forever. You still need to meet guidelines, and that is an important clarification. Other questions of members? Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Rosen, for bringing this forward. It's a great piece of legislation that I think addresses a very critical problem in our area. And I want to echo a little bit what Ms. Thurlow and Mr. Pearson were saying about the deeper issue here and the deep rural rates and the lower rates that they received. And, of course, that creates a disparity over time as you're adding percentage increases. A percent increase on, you know, a lower rate obviously isn't going to be as much, and those disparities continue to grow as time goes on. And so that's left the deep rural nursing homes in very critical condition. I guess the only concern that I have, again, is if it goes far enough. Obviously, it's because there's such a great need out there. And, you know, I wonder how many nursing homes would actually qualify to be critical access that won't be able to receive the funds because there's just not enough to meet their needs. And I don't know if anybody has any answers as to what, if you really addressed all the needs of what these deep rural nursing homes were, what the cost would be in order to cover it. All those that really should be considered critical access nursing homes, because there will be some that really should be but can't be because the resources aren't available to do that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Eakin, and thank you for all your work, too. And thank you to my co-authors. This is truly a bipartisan bill in its purest form, and I nobody could say it better than you, Senator Eakin.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 973? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 973, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
members.
Thank you, Senator Hayden, Senate File 1013. Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Here's our $10 million, Senator Carl.
Thank you. good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I have, looks like Senate File 1013, I guess to start, Mr. Chair, we should maybe incorporate this oral amendment and take and change the number. I'd like to, on line 1.6, strike the $10 million and put in $1.2 million.
On that motion, this would be an author's motion. First time it's been heard.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if we should change the date on it as well.
the date.
Oh,
beginning.
That would help.
Yeah. Steph, what should the prop? What would the proper date be? Anybody?
2015,
Senator? 2014? 14. 15? 14. So also strike 2013 and insert 2014. Is that correct, Senator Hayden?
That's correct.
All right. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Hayden, on the bill.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today, I have a bill. It's an ongoing appropriation to the Long-Term Supportive Housing Fund, which is administered by the Hearth Connection. Many of you are familiar with the Hearth Connection and the great work that they have done ending long-term homeless across the state. We have they have had a long-term or an appropriation over the years that had gotten cut over the years, and we are looking to try to bring them back so that they can not only continue the great work that they do, which essentially is taking people who have been long-term homeless, which is in statute a definition, and if I remember right, I think it is three times in 4 years. Or one continuous year, if I remember. That's what, when we say long-term homeless, that's what we mean, so that we can also continue to do that as well as continue to serve other parts of the state that we're looking. We know as of the latest Wilder survey that we still have a problem in dealing with the homeless, though we've made considerable pathway on what we're considering long-term homeless. So we want to continue to see if we can do that. Mr. Chair, I could go on forever. Many of you know that this is an organization that I worked for before I came to the legislature, so I'm always proud to come before them. But I would like to introduce their new executive director, Mr. Charlie Cook, to talk a little bit about their work. And then I think Mr. Kelby Grove will have some other testimony as well.
Mr. Cook. Welcome to the committee. Restate your name for the record.
My name is Charlie Cook. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I greatly appreciate this opportunity. I'm the executive director of Hearth Connection, and as Senator Hayden mentioned, I'm pretty new at it. So I'm going to try my best to represent that agency as well as I can. The Hearth Connection provides supportive housing to people who have experienced long-term homelessness and their families. The term long-term homeless includes a person of any age and any family configuration, as Senator Hayden has mentioned, that has been homeless for a year or longer, or homeless at least four times in the past 3 years. And that comes out of the housing and urban development definitions. HUD specifically targets people who have experienced long-term homelessness because the effects of the stability provided by housing coupled with intensive services pays off. It pays off with less reliance on emergency services, emergency room, detox, county shelter, less involvement with law enforcement, the courts, and corrections. In short, a safer, healthy community. I support the bill for this increased funding for long-term homeless support services, kind of a mouthful, isn't it? Because it will help more people achieve safe, secure, stable housing and improve functioning. I mentioned improve functioning, and I will mention briefly that the reason we know this is we track individuals throughout their participation with our funding and our services on something called a self-sufficiency matrix that measures, I believe, 18 different domains of self-sufficiency. So we can show their progress over time and that their situation changes, their safety changes, their levels of education, their ability to manage on a day-to-day basis changes in positive ways. Like Senator Hayden said, I would love to go on and on about stories, but I think you've already heard them. Many of you were probably here on when the homeless day on the Hill occurred. In Minnesota, long-term homelessness is growing slower, but it's still growing. And this group faces multiple barriers. And again, citing the data coming from the Wilder Foundation in 2012, overall, people experiencing homelessness have the following characteristics. 61% have a serious mental illness. 26% have a chemical dependency. 19% have a dual diagnosis, mentally ill and chemical dependent. 16% of men are veterans. 32% of women are experiencing homelessness as a result of domestic violence. The study identified 2,600 adults and unaccompanied minors experiencing long-term homelessness. That, in addition, there were 914 children accompanying that. So that's in 2012. That's the number of people who are still considered long-term homeless, and that are the people that are not currently served. Of those served by Hearth Connection, over 80% have a mental health disability, 64% have a chemical dependency issue, and some 35% have a chronic health condition. All live in poverty. Most grew up that way. By choice, we serve those at highest risk because we believe that that's where the highest payoff is. Hearth Connection currently serves 771 households, including 496 children. Hearth Connection pairs rental assistance with intensive support services to help support, to help assure that once individuals and families are housed, they receive enough support to stay housed and improve functioning. Many have no prior successful rental history, so of course part of the services provided are tenancy support to guide that tenant-landlord relationship. Intensive support services provide help in gaining access to health care for critical treatment, securing transportation, child care, access to support groups, community support and assistance, faith-based resources, education, job training and readiness, and that's just a handful. There's many more ideas that we work with. Long-term homeless support services funding stabilizes individuals and families, and that stability bolsters progress for kids who stay in the same schools instead of starting anew each time the family shifts to a new place to live. Adults and children are safer and more likely to participate in the community. The long-term term, that mouthful again, long-term homeless support services fund has brought much-needed services to many Minnesotans with proven results. However, there are regions of the state that have not yet had any access to these funds. The funding included in this bill could put in place the Central Minnesota Regional Project to begin offering this type of enhanced service model. This expansion could cover Stearns, Benton, Wright, Sherburn, Isanti, Kennebec, Mille Lacs, Pine, and Chisago counties. Hearth Connection recently worked with these counties in Central Minnesota to establish the collaborative, which in turn applied for long-term supportive services funding last year, but existing funding was insufficient to start a new region. Again, the most recent data from Wilder indicates that some 600 people are homeless in the central region. Roughly a third of them are under 18. Of those, 194 households are considered long-term homeless and could benefit from the funding proposed. Quoting the Wilder Foundation once again, for those who will need ongoing supportive services to stay in housing, we have seen success in the creation of a new supportive housing opportunities as part of the statewide plans for ending homeless, Heading Home Minnesota. But the new supportive housing falls far short of keeping up with the need that is created daily. I urge you to consider this proposal favorably, and again, on behalf of those that this would serve, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I see you have one more testifier.
No, I think we were just going to be here for questions.
Okay. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hayden,
yes, sir.
You just slashed long-term homeless funding by almost $9 million. Why the drastic change?
Senator Hayden.
Well, I'm always open for an oral amendment, Senator Brown, if you'd like to. I'm hoping to make sure that we shared some of the resources with other members of the committee that had needs as well.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, does your bill, is this for the broad scope or is this specifically for Hearth's Connection?
It's the broad scope.
It's for the long-term supportive housing fund. The Hearts Connection has been one of the principal administrators of the long-term homeless fund. They do work in 36 counties? 27 counties throughout the state, and it's geographically proportionate. They have a northern region, the range, and the greater Duluth area, the metro, and then they also have a southern region that runs along the I-14 corridor.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1013? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 1013 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Hayden.
All right, Senator Lurie. Move in.
Thank you, buddy. Fantastic. Absolutely. Good.
Well, wait.
You like the bill of that. It should be easy peasy, right?
Oh, that's right.
No.
Oh, Melissa was moving too much.
Okay. I thought she was leaving.
I am my green camera. Okay. So we won't give him the courtesy.
You could push her out the way.
Oh.
Oh.
Why is it?
Keep
it with him.
Two questions.
Yes.
So up next, Senate File 2658, Senator Lurie.
Chair and members, Senate File 2658 is administrative simplification for our human services as they are out in the counties. It's really a top priority for counties. They worked collaboratively with the department over the interim to identify ways to streamline our public programs. The results of this, real quickly, will be far better customer service and outcomes for those seeking assistance from our programs. It's really critical for the IT modernization funds that we put in place last year. If they're actually going to be effective, we have to have a set of rules that are actually able to be put into a new code. It will reduce administrative costs significantly at the counties. It will reduce error rates for those applying and really help with program integrity issues as we move forward. I'll step you through the bill as quickly as I can. It is a sizable bill. And what it does is really establishes a new chapter of law which contains uniform procedures for determining asset limits, earned income disregard, self-employment earnings, and verification of documentation for four of our public assistance programs, general assistance, which is GA, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, MSA, Group Residential Housing, GRH, and MFIP. The majority of the sections in the bill really incorporate cross-references to the new chapter and strike redundant and obsolete language in existing law. Section 1 is purely technical. It deletes a reference to a general assistance subdivision that is repealed. Sections 2 through 8 cover the GA portion of the program. They strike obsolete language and add cross-references to the new chapter of law with regard to the self-employment earnings, the definition of agency, the transfer of property, earned income, and personal property limitations. Sections 9 through 11 apply to the MSA program, again, striking obsolete language and adding cross-references to the new chapter. They strike language regarding the verification of income and add a cross-reference to the chapter. Section 10 is technical, changes the term recipient to participant for consistency across these four programs. And these sections also clarify that for an individual receiving SSI, the determination of resources does not change, but for individuals who do not receive SSI, the resource standards are explained under this new chapter of law. Sections 12 and 13 are for the group residential housing program, and they insert the definition of agency, cross-reference the new definitions in the new chapter, and reference the restrictions and standards in the new chapter. Sections 14 to 30, a big chunk of the bill, are in regards to the MFIP portion. They strike obsolete and redundant language again, add references to the replacement provisions in this new chapter of law, and strike references to the shared household standard, which is repealed as proposed in here. Section 31 provides that the four programs, again, GA, MSA, GRH, and MFIP, are subject to the requirements under this new chapter. Section 32 defines terms. Section 33 relates to personal property limitations. In essence, the personal property of an assistance unit cannot exceed $10,000, and one vehicle per eligible driver is excluded from this amount. Section 34 establishes the earned income disregard. It is 65% of earned income plus half of the remaining earned income per month. Of note is that this is the calculation based on the SSI disregard, which is the current calculation for two of the programs, GRH and MSA. Section 35 specifies the procedures for documenting, verifying, and receiving eligibility, and moves existing law and consolidates it all in the new chapter. So you will see a lot of deletions in here, and much of it is moved into this new chapter. Section 36 adds a new section of law regarding the self-employment earnings. They are significantly simplified under this section. Essentially, the agency must determine self-employment as either one half of the participant's gross earnings from self-employment or taxable income as determined by an IRS tax form provided. Section 37 allows the commissioner to continue efforts to simplify and make uniform program requirements by allowing them to come forward next year with additional recommendations. And Section 38 repeals redundant provisions in MFIP, GA, GRH, and MSA programs, and repeals the MFIP shared household standard in order to simplify the eligibility process for participants. And again, the key goals of this are to enhance customer service and the outcomes of individuals seeking public assistance through our counties. It's again critical for the IT maintenance, the value out of the IT enhancements that we funded last year. Critical to understanding this is the OLA report that came out a couple of years ago and found, and I'll read the quote right from it, that Minnesota's human services system is overly complex with many eligibility rules too complex to automate. I mean, we really have to do this simplification if we're going to get the bang out of the buck for the IT enhancements that we funded last year. It'll reduce administrative costs and error rates and really enhance program integrity. So with that, I have Judith Broomfield with the counties here to help answer questions. I know that representatives of DHS are here as well. They have worked very hard at putting this package together.
Mr. Chair,
and we have an amendment. Yep. The technical amendment just dealing with active dates, it is the A2 amendment, and I would offer that at this time.
Excuse me.
Any questions on the amendment from members? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
No, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Lurie, when you're testifier.
Ready to take questions from members.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Senator Benson.
Is the fiscal note impacted by the amendment, or is it drafted as amended? I'm just thinking.
Fiscal
you might
note is drafted. The amendment is to come into compliance with the fiscal note, is my understanding from DHS. That's correct?
Yes.
That is correct. Why don't you get where I can see where you're nodding?
Mr. Senator Lurie, would your testifier like to proceed? Is it Judith?
Well, they're just here to answer questions. I mean, I think that's, unless you want.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm noticing also, I know the efficiency and some of these other things, but in reading through the fiscal note, it also states that many cases that currently fail and are not able to be approved under any of these programs, a high percentage of them now would proceed, and therefore, you know, my question was, is the fiscal note due to increased employees at the county or the state level, or is this increased benefits to these programs or increased funding? If you could just explain that fiscal note a little bit more.
Senator Lori or testifier, can you please identify yourself?
Mr. Hosh here with the department to answer questions about the fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer. I'm Larry Hosh with the Department of Human Services. Senator Kiffmeyer, the fiscal note is attributable to larger caseload sizes, mostly connected to the increase in asset limits and the earned income disregard. With the increase in the earned income disregard, as an individual earns more money, that is disregard, and they're able to stay on the program a little longer so you don't have as much of a cliff. But that's one of the things attributable to the earned income disregard is it rewards work, that if you work, you'll be able to – it'll incentivize work because you don't have that dollar-for-dollar cliff in benefits when you do go to work.
Ms. Broomfield?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, you asked also...
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Judith Broomfield. I'm the Health and Human Services Director in Scott County and representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and the County Human Services Directors. Your question also about increased staff. The counties also did a fiscal note estimating what our savings would be if this went into effect. This notebook indicates the current policy manual that our staff need to follow. By eliminating this amount of work for them, we will be able to absorb the increased caseloads without adding additional staff. We also anticipate, obviously, being able to modernize our systems, which, again, would increase our efficiency. So, yes, the fiscal note talks about increased benefits or increased caseloads because more people stay on programs longer. But it also means for us that we can absorb that without increased staffing.
Any further questions, Senator
Kiffmeyer? No, I think that answers the question. Thank you.
Any more discussion?
Madam Chair, I forgot one more thing.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Are these, I read in the fiscal note, and again, you kind of wade through all of this, but are these now lined up with federal standards, or are these Minnesota-specific, such as income disregard, assets, and so on? I thought I read in one line that it was, but I wasn't quite sure.
Mr. Hosh, or?
Mr. Hosh, probably.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the earned income disregards would align with the SSI disregard that is currently in place, and we're unable to change the SSI disregard because it is a federal program. So that alignment moves to the federal disregard. So all of our programs, where we currently have four programs with four different disregards, we would have four programs with one single disregard.
And that single disregard now will be, if you could just summarize, since it's the same for all of them.
Mr. Hosh.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the disregard would be for the first $65 of an individual's earnings would be disregarded, and then 50% of any earnings thereafter would be disregarded.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yeah, what I was wondering about, there's no cap on that, or is that the assumption that you couldn't stay in the program if that 50% of the income above the $65 reached a certain limit? You wouldn't be in the program anyway? Is that the assumption?
Ms. Broomfield?
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that is correct. There still is the limit on eligibility. So when your income reaches that limit on eligibility, you would no longer remain on the program.
Okay, that does it now.
Thank you. Any further comments, questions? With that, hearing none, the questions on the motion of Senate file, moving Senate file 2658 to be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus bill.
As amended.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
No, same sign. Motion carries. We are adjourned. Oh, see?
No, we don't have